And now the man who made a deal with the devil for this show, and got shortchanged, my canon.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Halloween edition of the Mike Cannon Show. We'll be starting out this hour with more music and goofiness from horror movies, and end this hour with a couple paranormal stories from a group of real-life Ghostbusters, the White Crow Society. The hour following this one will be more traditional goth and Halloween music. That's what you got to look forward to this week's special edition of my Canon Indie Media Radio program, the Halloween edition. Let's get right into it.
You'll never grow old, Michael, and you'll never die, but you must feed.
Sister, love is with your brother. Klaatu, Varada, Nikto.
Klaatu, Varada, okay then. That's it.
Once a normal, voluptuously beautiful woman, she drove into a nightmare of horror and saw descending from the sky a titanic monster whose fearsome touch became a frightful curse. Attack of the 50-foot woman, incredibly huge, with incredible desires for love and vengeance.
I don't mean to embarrass you, but I'm a rather brilliant surgeon. Perhaps I could help you with that hump.
What hump?
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Bruno!
do, but he told us where we stand. And Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in a cellular jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space. And this is how the message ran.
Listening to the special Halloween edition of the Mike Cannon Show. Okay, be scared.
Not since the beginning of time has man known such terror.
No. Ah!
Creature from the Black Lagoon.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. He hasn't changed for millions of years.
Science was baffled, but there it was in the deep, deep waters of the Amazon. A living link with the dawn of time. Powerful, destructive. A woman's beauty, the bait that brought it out of its lair. See underwater thrills never photographed before in this most terrifying of all science fiction adventures. Creatures on the Black Lagoon.
Little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
We'll be right back. Well, well, well. Two naughty, nasty little children gone. Three good, sweet little children left.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down.
scared yet, you will be. But never of 93.3 WNRBLP Wausau.
A bunch of years ago, I was a founding member of the White Crow Society in New York before I moved away to take a job in another state. Our goal in the White Crow Society was a very simple one. It was to help those in need, no matter where the evidence took us, investigators. The primary person was to help our clients. And it almost always took them to a very mundane, non-parapsychological way of dealing with whatever phenomenon they were experiencing with. Frankly, most calls to the organization were from people who were off their meds. There was, however, a few very strange cases. Here are a couple strange reports off of a CD. These are actual cases from a file of the White Crow Society. Most of these reports only last a couple minutes long. Thanks for listening to this Mike Cannon New Media Radio program, a special Halloween edition.
The Blind Poltergeist. Dr. Walter Franklin Prince, a famous 20th century psychical researcher, called poltergeist the tornadoes of the paranormal. The term poltergeist, from the German, literally translates to noisy ghost. Ironically, though, poltergeists have nothing to do with ghosts or spirits of the dead. Most researchers now believe poltergeists are the unconscious psychokinetic outbursts of living people. Recent pioneering work by parapsychologists such as Dr. William Roll suggests that when certain individuals are put under tremendous stress, they release unconscious energy that can move objects, create noises, and shatter glass or twist metal. It appears that the great majority of poltergeist agents are teenage girls going through puberty. Some parapsychologists have suggested that poltergeist phenomena may be related to the release of the powerful hormones active during puberty. There are two things that must be remembered when studying poltergeist phenomena, or what modern scientists call recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. First, the living agent responsible for the phenomena is not aware they are doing it. Second, the phenomena often wears itself out in a couple of weeks, as opposed to hauntings that can last centuries. However, these modern explanations in no way diminish the destructive and frightening power of poltergeists. Poltergeists have been known to burn down buildings, explode objects, and even seriously injure researchers and the poltergeist agents themselves. Poltergeists, without doubt, are one of the most dramatic and frightening phenomena of all the paranormal world.
Eagle River, Wisconsin, February 1998. Tammy Walschlager was an average Midwestern 18-year-old, except for the fact that she was blind. She had lost her sight in a car accident as a child, but had managed to overcome her disability to hold down a job as a receptionist at a veterinarian's office. She lived with her fiancé, Kevin, in a cozy two-story house in rural Wisconsin. She seemed to be the last person you would imagine to have a paranormal experience, yet in the winter of 1997, Tammy's life would take a dramatic change towards the bizarre. When Tammy was alone in her house, strange things began to occur. Doors would lock and unlock by themselves, rapping sounds filled the rooms, and the phone would ring with no one on the other end save for low whispering voices. At first, Tammy and Kevin assumed it must be some of the local teenagers playing pranks. They called the sheriff, who came out several times but never saw any evidence of trespassing or horseplay. They changed their phone number, but the eerie calls persisted, as did the noises in the house. After a few weeks of this, the activity intensified. Once, while Tammy was cooking, all of the electrical appliances in the house turned on simultaneously. The radio played, even though it had been unplugged for weeks. When Kevin came home, he found all the music tapes unraveled in the hall and Tammy terrified in her bed. It was at this time that their dog, Samson, refused to enter the house and began to lose his fur from stress. Kevin, who was a practicing Catholic, insisted on bringing in a priest. The elderly priest spent a night in the troubled home but found no evidence of the infernal. He performed a blessing on the house and pronounced the matter resolved. But it was far from resolved. Soon after he left, the entire house began to shake. Loud knocking noises emanated from the front door. Kevin darted from their bed to investigate. While he was outside, the window of their upper-story bedroom exploded, showering Kevin with shattered glass. After returning from the hospital, the frightened couple went to bed, only to be awakened a few hours later. Tammy's talking computer for the blind suddenly came to life. "Help me," it implored. "Help me. Help me." Over and over again, the computer's mechanical voice pleaded, even after it was unplugged. The next day, Tammy called a local psychic for help. The psychic arrived, confident in her ability to clean the house. Her confidence soon turned to terror when her teacup exploded in her hand. She fled the house, vowing never to return. Terrified and desperate, the couple contacted a local university that put them in touch with the White Crow Society. After investigating the site and researching the couple's medical history, the researchers determined that Tammy was the root of the phenomena. In their report, they wrote the following. After doing research on the house, it became clear that the site itself is not haunted. There was only one prior resident who, when interviewed, claimed not to have experienced anything paranormal in the house. None of the phenomena occurred when Tammy was away from the house. It seemed only to manifest in her direct vicinity. When the researcher looked at her medical records, he found the key. Tammy had recently experienced unexplained seizures prior to the phenomena occurring. It was the researcher's belief that these seizures had created violent outbursts of unconscious psychokinetic energy.
Though Tammy's case was exceptionally violent and frightening, it was relatively easy to resolve. When it was determined Tammy was the poltergeist's agent and that the phenomena was related to her uncontrolled seizures, the researchers suggested she begin a course of anti-seizure medication. The taking of the medication completely ended the phenomena, and Tammy and Kevin were allowed to return to their normal lives. The curse of the melting face. Though widespread, psychic assaults are some of the least understood of all paranormal phenomena. Psychic assaults are related to the various and persistent folk beliefs in curses, hexes, witchcraft, and spells. Put simply, psychic assaults are the psi influence of one person over another, which can take a variety of forms. On the positive side, this influence could result in psychic healing at a distance, as reported in recent medical journals. However, with the ability to heal at a distance also comes the uncomfortable potential of causing harm at a distance. Earlier cultures had elaborate rituals to protect themselves from all sorts of witchcraft, spells, curses, evil eyes, and other remote negative influences. Anthropological ethnographies are filled with stories of terrible psychic assaults, like Australian Aboriginal bone pointing, Haitian voodoo spells, and the withering influence of the evil eye in Mediterranean cultures. However, psychic assaults are not limited to primitive faraway cultures. In fact, there has been a recent increase in the number of psychic assault claims in Europe and the United States. Dion Fortune's immensely popular book, Psychic Self-Defense, has warned millions about the danger of occult influences on one's health and sanity. Though there is little scientific understanding on how psychic assaults work and much controversy over their nature, their effects are undeniable and sometimes deadly.
Santa Fe, New Mexico, June 1998. The following account is taken from the journals of Martin Cruz and the notes of a White Crow Society investigator.
December 10th, 1997. I've been seeing Eli for almost a month now. I'm hesitant to use the word love, but I think I could fall for this guy. Still, he's definitely a little bit on the weird side. I swear to God his entire wardrobe must be comprised of black, and he's constantly reading books about the occult and devil worship. He even gave me one after our last night out. Something about the history of magic by a guy named Aleister Crowley. February 16th, 1997. Eli almost redeemed himself on Valentine's Day. He hadn't called me for nearly a week, and when he finally did, I couldn't help but get bitchy on the phone. He invited me over, and he'd cooked dinner, bought champagne, the whole romantic nine yards. After the meal, he took me into the bedroom where he had candles all over the place. He said he wanted to do a ritual that would bond us forever. It was pretty spooky seeing him all serious and into it, but it was kind of sweet, too. My head says take it slow, but my heart says go, go, go. April 18th, 1997. How does this seem to happen to me every time? I meet a guy, fall for him, and next thing I know he turns out to be a jealous psycho headcase. I don't even like to go out with Eli anymore. His jealousy has gotten to the point where I feel like I'm suffocating. If another guy even looks at me, Eli totally freaks out. He keeps saying over and over again how beautiful I am and how everyone wants me. At first it was super flattering. Now it's getting to be a drag. I made some comment about how maybe we should take some time apart, and he totally flipped out. May 1st, 1998. May Day, and I finally did it. I broke it off with Eli, and it was a total drama scene at work. I did it on our break, so he couldn't do anything too major about it. I was wrong. He gave me a look like I was some kind of a monster and told me, "I curse you, so you'll be so ugly that no one will ever have you." It was spooky. But the really creepy thing was waiting for me on the living room table when I got home. Eli had made some sort of weird magical altar. The thing had black candles burning all over it, and pieces of my hair, I don't know where the hell he got those, and clothing on it. I threw it out in the trash. Good riddance to Eli. May 9th, 1998. People at work keep telling me I look tired. I've got huge bags under my eyes. The weird thing is I get plenty of sleep, no empty bed syndrome after kicking Eli out. I guess I should start taking vitamins or something. May 27th, 1998. The doctor's visit was a mixed blessing. At least I don't have the dreaded face-eating bacteria or a stroke. But he has no clue to what's causing it. 10 days of tests and modern science still has no idea what's making me look like sh**, and I do. Each day I can see my face droop a little bit farther. What the hell is happening? I've almost used up my sick days for work, but I don't want people seeing me like this. The doctor scheduled an appointment with a plastic surgeon. I've got my fingers crossed. I even started praying again. June 30th, 1998. The plastic surgery has kept my eyes open, for now, but the rest of my face is a mess. The doctor said all of my facial muscles are atrophying. Oh God, I think maybe there is something to this curse. I tried to talk to Eli, but David said he split town over a month ago with no forwarding address. I can't even look in the mirror anymore. I don't even recognize myself. I'm really scared, and I just want it to stop.
Late June, 1998. From the notes of a White Crow Society investigator.
I was assigned Martin's case. At first, I thought there had to be a physiological explanation. But according to the doctors, there is no medical precedent for what is happening to the client's face. I saw the before and after pictures and was shocked. The client's face is highly disfigured. It appears as though all his facial muscles have liquefied. I was able to track down the elusive Eli in a small town in California. I had hoped he would be able to help me prove to Martin that the so-called curse was in no way connected to his disfigurement. On the contrary, Eli took full credit for Martin's condition, and was even pleased upon seeing the photographs. When I asked him if he would be willing to remove the curse, he scoffed. I quote, "Do you have any idea how difficult it is to get a curse to stick?" Unfortunately, there was nothing else I could do to help Martin and his horribly progressive transformation.
Despite numerous plastic surgeries, Martin's face continues to erode. At present, Martin has filed a civil suit against Eli. The Goodbye Man. Parapsychologists have demonstrated that the human mind is capable of many strange and wondrous things, such as telepathy, psychokinesis, and precognition. But undoubtedly, the strangest manifestation of the human mind is the thought form, or tulpa. The tulpa is the exteriorization of an idea or thought. In other words, it literally is ideas made real. The word tulpa is a Buddhist term that loosely translates as mind shadow. Alexandra David Neal, in her book Magic and Mystery in Tibet, discussed her experiences of journeying to a lama and studying the techniques of tulpa formation. But like the sorcerer's apprentice, the lessons of the master soon grew out of control in the hands of the student. It took the Tibetan lamas 6 months to dissolve the semi-autonomous tulpa. Thought forms have long been a standard part of not only Eastern mysticism, but also Western magic. Most recently, a Toronto group of parapsychologists attempted to create a laboratory tulpa they affectionately referred to as Philip. Though the parapsychologists didn't get full exteriorization, they did get a variety of interesting phenomena, including wraps and table and other object levitation. Finally, it should be noted that tulpas almost inevitably turn mischievous and sometimes even dangerous.
Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, August 1991. It was almost 10 years ago that the three of us put away the Ouija board and promised never to speak of the goodbye man again. Even saying the name frightens me. For as the first spirit guides told us, do not even think of him, for your thoughts make him stronger and bring him closer. But how can I not? How do I push from my mind the image of a man who is not entirely a man, who kills with abandon? A monster who haunts the back regions of America just as he haunts my mind. I feel the only way to purge him from my mind for good is to tell his story, even at the risk of giving him power. It is a story I advise you to listen to carefully and then forget forever, if you can. It all began one afternoon in the summer of 1990. Mick, James, and myself were students at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Bored, and with the many weeks of summer stretching before us like so many pages in a blank book, we racked our brains for something out of the ordinary to do. Mick and James were fascinated with the occult and had received an antique Ouija board from a friend. The story was that the board itself was cursed and had been thrown out by some spooked students. Eager to try it out, we settled in on the floor of Mick's cramped apartment, lighting candles and incense, with Mozart's Requiem floating from the stereo. Nothing happened for several hours. We tried different combinations of people on the planchette with no success. At last, when we were ready to give up entirely, the planchette, as if sensing our frustration, began slowly to come to life. Mick grabbed his notebook and began copying the letters as they became visible through the circle of the planchette. The speed of the marker began to increase. Soon it moved so fast that it was nearly impossible for Mick to keep up with it. After a few sessions, we created a system to ensure that no one was somehow faking it, despite the fact that we each professed total innocence of this. Mick was still the scribe. He would blindfold us and turn the board around several times a session so that it would be impossible for us to locate the letters. With all the precautions in place, intelligible messages still poured out so rapidly that Mick could barely keep up. At first there was only one, but soon this one spirit gave way to many. Each of them seemed to have a distinct style of speech and pace with the planchette. Some used abbreviations, some were slow, laboriously spelling out every word, while others moved at such speed as to twist our wrists and exhaust our hands. Even the board itself had a persona. We spent days speaking to various spirits and filled notebooks with their bizarre communications. A pattern began to emerge in the chaos of words. Each of the spirits seemed obliquely to be referring to another, though they would never mention his name. The spirits seemed almost afraid of this mysterious entity, and all of our inquiries about this unnamed other would result in the planchette ceasing to move. At first, the activity with the board had seemed fun. Later, it became fascinating, if slightly unnerving. But at the mention of this seemingly malevolent mystery spirit, our group split. I wanted to stop. I had no desire to discover anything that would actually frighten spirits. But James, on the other hand, was obsessed with uncovering the secret of the board. We each turned to Mick for the final vote. He shrugged his shoulders, but I could tell his curiosity overrode his fears. We began conducting our sessions exclusively at night. The spirits seemed more active then. Mick and James attempted a new strategy with the board. They demanded to know the identity of the unnamed spirit. When the board continued to be cryptic, they threatened to cease any further contact with the spirits altogether. All but one of the spirits ignored the bluff. They disappeared from our sessions, leaving us with our lone guide, the spirit of the board. The board began to tell us the story of the goodbye man. Unlike the rest of the guides, the goodbye man wasn't a spirit. He was something else. His history was uncomplicated. The board told us the story in fits and starts, begging us to cease our inquiries every few minutes, but we foolishly persisted. The goodbye man was born sometime in the 30s. An albino, he was born blind and given up to an orphanage by his parents in Algiers, Louisiana. As a child, the goodbye man would frequently run away from the orphanage, only to be caught and brought back. By the time he was a teenager, he butchered a nurse who attempted to capture him with a pair of scissors. There was a full manhunt for him, but he disappeared altogether, except for the disturbing stories. There were reports of a man fitting his description who was hoboing on freight cars of the South, and periodically they would find mutilated corpses by the tracks. The goodbye man slipped into folk legend amongst those working and living by the railroad. They attributed all kinds of powers to this strange albino creature who traveled the rails. The board said that the train yards were filled with displaced folks from the Depression. Even then, people would never say the name of this man who rode the rails as they traded stories over campfires and in boxcars. When asked, even the board didn't know how he got his name, just that he traveled alone, or almost alone. He carried with him a duffel bag full of gore, cut from his victims. Some thought he was a cannibal, but the board told us it was even worse. We learned that the goodbye man had a kind of pet named Doomsinger. Doomsinger was a creature crudely stitched together, comprised of nothing but the tongues and eyes of the goodbye man's victims. But this thing was more than a pet. It acted as his eyes. It would whistle back to him and lead him toward his victims. Most terrifying of all, the board warned us that the goodbye man was actually animated by those who thought of him. He did not kill indiscriminately. Instead, he would hone in on those who thought of him, their thoughts like a kind of beacon drawing Doomsinger and him closer. Mick told us to ask the board where the goodbye man was right now. The board spelled out Chicago and added that he was aware of us and moving closer. Mick put his hand over ours to still the planchette. He read us back the story that we had spelled out without seeing. My throat was dry as I spoke. I felt like that scary movie that you can't leave, can't shut off. "That's it," I said. "It ends here." Mick and James tried to convince me to continue, but I was adamant in my terror. I knew they could go no further without me. For some reason, the board was only receptive when I was one of the people operating the planchette. That seemed to be the end. After weeks of communicating, we finally folded up the board and put it away for good. The next few weeks, we tried to forget the goodbye man, but that wasn't easy. None of us were sleeping well. When we did actually sleep, our dreams were disturbing, and we would repeatedly wake at the same time in the middle of the night. 3 o'clock. With no joy, Mick told me that this was the soul's midnight, the time when more people die than any other. Several weeks later, with the goodbye man just beginning to fade from my mind, Mick and I went for a walk on an island near Wausau, Wisconsin. Luckily, Mick didn't tell me then the story of the island. Apparently, a number of years ago on this island, a woman was found mutilated by a pair of scissors. But ignorant of that grisly tale, I was simply enjoying the day and Mick's company when we began to cross a railroad bridge back to the mainland. I watched Mick moving ahead of me, throwing the loose gravel into the water. Then I heard a faint noise. It was a soft whistle sounding from somewhere behind me. At first I thought it must be the wind in the trees or a far-off train whistle, but whistling grew louder, as if it was slowly moving up behind me. Gathering my courage, I turned around. There was no one behind me, yet I could still hear the whistling steadily closing in. I began to run toward Mick, screaming as I ran, "Do you hear it?" The whistle seemed as though it was right behind me, following me, getting closer and closer, till it was right in my ear. Yet it stopped when I reached Mick, who never heard a thing. When we returned to Sun Prairie, there was a message on my machine from James. His voice had an edge of panic to it. Did you stop by my place last night? Was that you, Jennifer, in the middle of the night? I called James to find out what he was talking about. How could I have stopped by his place when I wasn't even in the same town? When he answered the phone and I asked him this, he grew silent on the other end. After almost a minute, all I could hear was him breathing. Then he told me his story. The prior night, he'd been sleeping soundly in his bed when he suddenly bolted awake from a loud knock at his door. Groggy with sleep, he shuffled to the door and was just about to open it when he checked his clock. It was exactly 3 a.m. He waited silently by the door, and then he heard my voice. James? James? It's Jennifer. Come on, James, open up the door. James reached the door handle, but something stopped him from turning it. A cold filled him as though a winter draft had passed over him. What do you want? Open the door, James. Open the door. Come on, let's go out for breakfast. He backed away from the door and lay down on the floor. In the small space under the door, he could see the shadow of a figure. He waited until the shadow slowly stepped away and closed his eyes. If this was a dream, he thought, I'll wake up in my bed. If it's not, and I can somehow fall asleep, I'll wake up on the floor. 4 hours later, James opened his eyes and found himself stretched out on the cold, hardwood floor of his bedroom. When we next met, Mick speculated on what would have happened if James had opened the door. I lost it. It was as if the tension of all those weeks suddenly built to a breaking point. Tears running down my face and my voice shaking with fear, I told them we must never speak of the goodbye man again. We joined hands, and I made them swear to it, swear on our friendship. I thought it would never be me who'd break the solemn oath, and I do not do it lightly. I tell this story not to incite the curiosity of others, but to close the door that must never, ever be opened.
Mick later went on to found the White Crow Society, where he independently investigated the tale of the Goodbye Man. He never found the exact identity of the Goodbye Man, but he did discover some interesting clues. First, there was an orphanage in Algiers, Louisiana, in the early 1930s. Second, from the late 30s until the 80s, there had been a series of mysterious murders of hobos and people traveling by freight train. A group calling themselves the Revolutionary Railroad Army took responsibility for many of the deaths. However, the manner of the grisly killings were reminiscent of the Goodbye Man's methods. In fact, today, Crusties, young freight-traveling punk rockers, continue the folklore of the mysterious maniac that travels the tracks, toting a duffel bag full of human body parts.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to these true cases of the paranormal. But more importantly, I hope you've learned something about what parapsychology is and how parapsychologists investigate unexplained cases. The names in the cases have been changed, and each story edited for length. However, each story truly represents the events and methods involved with a particular White Crow Society case. Each case is far from over, in the sense that each story is open to interpretation and further analysis. Parapsychology is a new science and has a lot to learn about the paranormal. It is our belief that by bringing these stories out to the public and up for debate, the White Crow Society, in a little way, has added to the science of parapsychology. Thank you and good night.
You are listening to 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio.